have the speaker who's to be introduced. It's my privilege as coordinator of student religious activities to have this part in the observance of our Religious Participation Week here at the University of Minnesota. This is a week which is sponsored jointly by all the religious foundations, 28 of them, on the Minneapolis campus, and on both the staff and student level. We have been attempting to acquaint students with the important place which religion should play in their lives and in their social relationships. President Wilson of the university, week before last, gave us a sort of advance kickoff, and on Monday, we had the pleasure of hearing Professor Yaroslav Pelikan from the University of Chicago, who spoke in this place on Monday afternoon. Our speaker today is one who has had a distinguished record in many fields. He's well known, of course, to Minnesotans, as our fine senator who represents us in Washington. He graduated from St. Thomas College and, we're happy to say, has a Master of Arts degree from the university, so we can welcome him as an alumnus, sharing with others. He also has Doctor of Laws degrees from St. Louis University and the College of St. Thomas. He was teaching sociology. He was acting head of the department at St. Thomas at the time of his election to Congress in 1948. And he served there in many distinguished capacities, and then in 1958 was elected to a six-year term to the Senate, the United States Senate. He's represented, it seems to me, in every one of his public utterances, the voice of conscience and conviction, and I think he has illustrated in his career in a very remarkable way the connection between religion or faith and one's responsibilities as a citizen. And the theme which he will speak on at this convocation for our Religious Participation Week is the bearing of religion on the political and social problems of today. Senator Eugene McCarthy.
And Dr. Allen, members of the faculty, and students of the university. I am to speak on the bearing of religion on the political and social problems of today. I was asked to speak on this subject some months ago, and we, the members of the United States Senate, suffer from it's a kind of an occupational weakness, I suppose, if we're asked to speak on any subject and given 2 months supposedly in which to prepare, why we agree to speak on any subject. Then at the time of your appearance or a few days before it, you begin to wonder whether or not you were somewhat too rash in accepting. And I've noted some of the truly genuine scholars who have, and specialists who have spoken in the course of this week on, not on this subject exactly, but on the related subject of religion and life and the bearing of religion on science and in other fields, I do feel some measure of inadequacy. If you get a member of Congress away from the congressional record, you know, in which we have immunity, the grounds that we can speak for the record without being well informed or without being very wise, and at least we can't be held legally accountable, we feel, especially after a 9-month session such as we've had and within the protective walls of the Congress itself, somewhat, well, not exactly frightened, but a little bit unsure. Christopher Dawson, in one of his recent books, has said that religion in his judgment, is the principal influence and the principal force in history, and that an understanding of religion in history is the key to the knowledge of history. Throughout the greater part of mankind's history, he writes, in all ages and in all states of society, religion has been the great central unifying force in culture. It has been the guardian of tradition, the preserver of moral law, the educator, the teacher of wisdom. And in addition to this conservative function, religion has also had a creative, dynamic function as the energizer and life giver. In all ages, the first creative works of culture have been due to religious inspiration and dedicated to a religious end. Religion, he said, stands at the threshold of all the great literatures of the world. Philosophy is its offspring. And the same is true, he says, of social institutions. Kingship and law are religious institutions. Well, I, of course, do not intend to challenge this general thesis or to attempt to improve upon it or to make this kind of fundamental inquiry into the bearing of religious upon political institutions and social problems. It is, I think, quite clear that religious beliefs, including those that are purely superstitious, do affect social life and the customs, particularly in elementary societies, in elementary political institutions, and of primitive people. This bearing and this influence is very direct. Nearly everything in such a society is conditioned or associated with religion. Tools and weapons and home and field and the elements of nature, the sun and the moon, the rain, the threshold of a home, the location of a city, natural objects, animals, all of these have been given divine and mystical powers or attributes. The bearing, too, of religious beliefs and of religious institutions is quite clearly written in the history of Western and Christian civilization. For centuries, a church and state were the two great institutional forces in that society, sometimes competing, sometimes working in harmony, giving form and giving direction to culture and to politics and to the structure and the substance of that society. Sometimes one dominated the other, sometimes their roles were confused. And at times it seemed as if the ideal synthesis had been achieved, but this, it turned out, was always a temporary condition. It seemed that persons and society were in some right measure rendering to Caesar what belonged to him and to God what belonged to him. But these happy conditions were unfortunately short-lived. But what of today? Do the religious beliefs of persons influence their views and attitudes on social and political problems in any discernible way or in any significant way? Does religion today have some positive bearing on life and on history? Is Dawson's thesis that one which really can be proved from the past but not proved in the present? Are religious beliefs of force only among primitives, or only when religious institutions possess juridical and legal and political strength and political status, and not a force in a more sophisticated civilization such as ours, and in a society in which religious institutions are limited by secular power or permitted to touch upon the secular world only indirectly? If we go to the extreme, we say, is God, as Nietzsche asserted, for practical purposes dead, and religion, the relationship between God and man, therefore a kind of dead circuit? Is religion, we might ask, still where it exists, only a kind of opiate of the people, a kind of vestige of the past, as Marx asserted? Have the Marxists rejected one religion only to replace it with one of their own making, a dogmatic one, as Reinhold Niebuhr has described it, in his words, derived from a religious apocalypse into which the communist power, not relying on its ideological or spiritual power, as has been the case, a somewhat mixed case with other religions, trying to coerce the whole of the historical process with all of its divergent and contradictory vitalities? Have Christians, and if I do most often refer to Christians and the Christian religion, it is not that I intend to exclude others from having somewhat the same bearing, but for the sake of not duplicating statements, and because our culture and the tradition of our culture is essentially a Christian one, ask the question that, raise the question at least, that Lenin once did, in referring to the differences among the various Christian religions, he said that they had, in a sense, become God creators. In our own time, some serious questions can be raised about attitude towards religion. There was a report out of the Pentagon several years ago of a study being undertaken there to develop a kind of GI religion in the hope that this could eliminate the number of chaplains to represent and to act for the various religious denominations who are now represented in the chaplain service. A kind of homogenizing of religion for practical purposes. Say, to the extent that this is a positive movement or has substance to it, it does give some strength to the charge which Mr. Lennon raised, that we do sometimes really proceed to create our own God or to make our own religion. Or the outdoor advertisers, public service advertising, urging us to worship at a church of our own choosing, more or less according to our own determination. Is there, we quite properly should ask, in Western culture, a kind of vacuum which is to be filled by a self-generating force, a kind of collective will, as it has been defined by Marxist, or by the will of the majority acting in every area of culture? The will of the majority is defined and sponsored by the advocates of democracy, a kind of absolutizing or deification of the will of the people, in which morality and religious response, in the new meaning of it, is to be expressed in conformity with this new kind of really moving and relative absolute, rather than in an effort to respond to in a creator-creature relationship. Is this the time to declare with those men who some years ago joined in a declaration published under the title of The City of Man, our faith in man's ability to make his way by his own means to that truth which is true for him, or to acknowledge that these self-determined truths or self-defined truths and this self-determined morality really cannot give direction and force to our lives in social and political and community activities? Is it correct to say that the whole of our culture has been secularized? This was the charge which was made, I think, most dramatically in the words of a soldier in Bernanos, The Diary of a Country Priest, in which the soldier charged the priest representing religion with having secularized the vocation, the profession of the soldier. To a degree, it is true that major aspects of our culture and of our lives have been set aside, really, from religious and from spiritual influence. In a decision written in the Zorich case in 1952, Justice Douglas, writing for the majority of the court, wrote, "We are a religious people whose institutions presuppose a supreme being." Well, this declaration on the part of the majority of the Supreme Court does not really in itself make us a religious people, any more than the fact that Congress, within the last 2 or 3 years, has made it a matter of law that all of our coinage carry the words, "In God we trust." We politicians suggest that this has not prevented inflation. Or the fact that we now have, as a matter of law, included the words, "Under God," in the Pledge of Allegiance. The men who framed the Constitution did accept essentially this thesis. They had a belief in a supreme being from whom they held man received certain inalienable rights. They believed that in this relationship there was a discoverable moral law applicable to men and to society, and they accepted the obligation of stewardship, which included two things, both freedom and responsibility, and growing from freedom and responsibility, also accountability. Religious beliefs do significantly affect our lives and bear upon social and political problems today. The relationship and the bearing, I think, is less clear than it would be in a society in which the church or religion held a clear juridical and external or public in the formal sense position in that society. In the formal sense, in the United States, church and state are kept separate. But it is absurd to hold that religion and politics, religion and social problems, can be kept wholly apart when they meet in the consciousness of each man and when each man acts as one person. Religion bears upon political and social problems basically in two ways. First, in its contribution to the fuller understanding of man's dignity, and in sustaining attitudes and institutions relating to sustaining and clarifying that dignity and attempting to achieve it and to perfect it in greater measure. We regularly assert that all men are equal in the eyes of God. We have no very clear proof of this. It may be true. As a practical matter, however, all men should be looked upon as equal in the eyes of other men, because no one of us can claim the title to pass upon the essential and the significant differences which do exist among men. Although we may do, and sometimes rashly and sometimes with justification, pass upon some of the particular differences among men. Paul Spock, the executive secretary of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, in addressing that body in 1957, sounded this kind of warning. He said that we, the nations of the Western world, and those who spoke for those nations and for that civilization, if we were going to continue to talk about the dignity of man, had to, in a sense, prove really our belief in it by attempting to extend political democracy wherever we could. He said if we were going to continue to talk about our great concern for the dignity of man, that we had to undertake to extend and to establish social justice in every part of the world in which we had power or influence. This responsibility, as stated by Spock, really backs up to our understanding of what we mean when we speak of the dignity of every person. This conception of man as dignified involves more than the simple observation of him as an individual in the course of a lifetime, or even the observation of mankind as one can come to know it in the pages of history. It requires a consideration of origin. It requires a consideration of purpose. If man is without freedom of choice, if he is a determined actor or a predetermined actor, the question of individual dignity becomes quite impersonal, and the person himself no more is deserving of credit than would a tree or a waterfall deserve individual credit for its beauty. If, on the other hand, man is responsible, and if he is accountable, as is held in the religion of the West and in other religions, then the whole question of his dignity and of the relationship of that to freedom must be faced. The idea of individual freedom and individual responsibility is basic to the political thought and the social thought of Western civilization. And this attitude, this set of ideas, is sustained by religious belief and strengthened by faith. Even those who deny themselves as having any religious belief, or deny that it has any bearing upon their own comprehension and their own analysis of human problems, are beholden to the religious beliefs of the past, which have been built into our traditions and have been built into the institutions of our society. Religion gives, I suppose we could say, a third and very necessary leg to the stool which sustains the claim to dignity, to the argument of necessity, to the argument which may come from reasoned reflection. It gives the support of belief, sustained by revelation, and of purpose, and of individual value. Religious beliefs, too, bear basically upon the question of power and responsibility. Man is different in kind from all other beings. He is created with a partial power to create himself, to anticipate the future, to plan for it, and to give some direction to history. He is the subject of history, exercising some control over it, as well as the object. The exercise of power, intellectual, moral, and creative, is a part of his nature. Religion does not set man against the use of power, but rather it calls upon him to exercise it with a full degree of responsibility, in service with a sense of stewardship. Man's sovereignty, and under this conception, stated by Romano Guardini in his book Power and Responsibility, is not meant to establish an independent world of man, but to complete the world of God as a free human world in accordance with God's intent and with God's will. And the work of man is to exercise power and to use power insofar as he can in conformity with this plan. Religious beliefs do have, of course, a more particular and more specific bearing upon political and social problems. Strictly speaking, there is no such thing as a Christian politics or a Christian political system or a Christian economic system or a Christian social structure. Or we could take the terminology of other religions and make the same assertion. Throughout the history of Christian civilization, at least, there have been political leaders and some religious leaders as well who have attempted to define and to describe the ideal Christian state. There's been disagreement among them. Some have seen the ideal state in a medieval synthesis of state and church and have looked to the restoration of a similar order in our own day. Others have conceived of the ideal Christian state as a monarchy with a Christian monarch defending both faith and country. And others, including a number of modern thinkers and some politicians of recent times, have envisioned the Christian state as a democracy founded upon the natural law. If the concept of a Christian politics or a Christian political system or a Christian economic or a Christian social system or that of any other religion is to be justified, it must be of such a kind that in its essential character, its Christian character if it calls itself Christian, or its Judaic character if it would appeal to the religion of Judaism, that it differs from every other, that it is distinctly and significantly and clearly religious as well as secular and political. Yet neither history nor political theory establishes any basis for the application of a truly religious label in any kind of absolute or final or essential sense to politics and to the social order. Recognition of a religion or of Christianity by the state does not make the state itself Christian. Neither does official approval of certain Christian forms and practices, nor does the fact that perhaps all citizens or the great majority of the citizens are Christians make that state essentially a Christian state. A government, I suppose, it might be distinguished as more or less Christian to the degree that it has either succeeded or failed in establishing a greater measure of justice, or to the degree that it shows its dedication to the accomplishment of that purpose. But this is really to borrow a title and to apply it without full justification. Such qualified application, however, is rather risky. And for the most part, we should be most careful not to apply Christian terms and Christian titles to problems of politics or to social problems unless they can clearly be identified as such. The person with religious faith must be on guard particularly against turning his religious beliefs into an instrument for making every political and every economic and every social policy or position he takes a kind of religious crusade, of saying on his side he has truth with certainty against error, or on his side he has good as opposed to evil, in the manner of the Inquisition, or in the manner of at least expressed by Cromwell, who, when Wharton protested Pride's Purge, responded that one should not be too critical of God's instruments because perhaps there was no other way to move. In the United States, this is not a very dangerous attitude. In some of the European countries, and of course in some of the Latin American countries, political parties are given religious designation. The Catholic Center Party, the Christian Democratic Party, and others of minor significance. There is a tendency in the United States, however, to claim for one's own position oftentimes a special kind of religious or spiritual significance. And it's not uncommon for men running for public office or those who are advocating a special kind of social reform to declare that their approach is non-political and that it is a moral and a spiritual one. This may be true, but the two are not necessarily at odds and not necessarily in contradiction. On the other hand, it is important that while we are concerned about the relationship and the bearing of religion upon politics and social action, that we continuously draw the line between what may be called for on the part of the state and what should be rejected. This conflict between conscience and the unjust or all-embracing state or society is age-old, and indeed as old as the history of mankind, and certainly as old as the history of Western civilization. the list of those men, the brave and the prudent, who after exhausting all possibilities fell back at last on the dictates of conscience goes back at least to Socrates, who was admired for his stand against the state and honored for his declaration when he said, "Men of Athens, I honor and love you, but I must obey God rather than you." Not only do we honor those who stand on conscience, but we consider a stand against injustice really the obligation of the responsible citizen. Sometimes it's difficult to draw the line. In our own time, the Nazi war crimes, although performed in the name of the state, have been challenged, and individuals were punished following the trials on the basis of the existence of a higher, although an unwritten law. This unwritten law was the basis for the judgment on the commander of the infamous prison camp of the American Confederacy, a judgment which was re-examined in the recent play, The Anderson Trial. No Christian, Dean Sayer of the Episcopal Cathedral of Washington said in a television program in June of 58, can grant to the state, and you could extend this to all secular institutions, any kind of absolute right over his conscience, not just to the state, but to the corporation or to any force of power. Any absolute right over his conscience. All, he said, owe allegiance to the Lord, an allegiance which is over and above and beyond the allegiance that he owes to the state. We say, what then can you expect in politics of religious people, of any faith? Can we determine in action, can we pass an objective and a positive judgment on their behavior, on the substance of their programs, on the manner in which they conduct themselves in office? In the first instance, we must pass a judgment upon Christians and religious men for having failed really to respond adequately to what are the demands of society, the demands of politics, and the demands in the social order. The failure, I think, has been manifest in, well, really three traditional and three significant ways. There has been an attitude among religious people, those who hold a religion, to somehow set themselves apart from what they call the secular world, an attitude of indifference, oftentimes explained on the grounds that there are really two cities. And so, for the sake of purity and for the sake of their integrity, they refuse to become involved. There's been a second disposition on the part of religious people to stand aside and simply to pass judgment upon the world, not to attempt to save it, but simply to judge it. This disposition was, I think, best described by Eric Gill in one of his essays when he said that Christians in modern times had been very much like someone standing on shore while there was a drowning in the water nearby. And the advice of the Christian has been to take good deep breaths of fresh air if the man wished to be saved. And a third mistake that's been made has been that of really confusing the obligation to save the world with simply trying to preserve it, accepting that everything that is necessarily good, and that since we identify certain secular institutions and practices, certain temporal institutions with religion, that the possibility of losing these things, which are accidental and which are temporal, becomes confused with the effort to save that which is true and that which is essential and that which is fundamental. Faith is, of course, no full and automatic substitute for knowledge or for intelligence. Although the truths of faith should, when applied to contemporary problems, have some bearing upon the understanding of the problem and some bearing upon the solution of human problems. The religious character of a people should be reflected in social and political institutions and actions. Francis Fisher, the Archbishop of Canterbury, made application in this way in an article that appeared in Look magazine, I think it was, about a year ago. He said, "Everything which touches the life of the nation must be of concern to the Christian and to the religious citizen. It does not," he said, "escape God's judgment by becoming, in the party sense, political. The difficulty is that when an issue has become, in a sense, political, people are less ready to hear what the Christian judgment may be, since for that judgment," he said, "patience and a perceptive mind are required. The knowledge of the Bible or the Koran, the Ten Commandments, or the spiritual and the corporal works of mercy does not, of course, give a man in politics or the person attempting to solve social problems a ready answer to each and every problem. Awareness and acceptance of the obligation to feed the hungry does not immediately solve the agricultural surplus problem in the United States. but it should be expected to dispose the person dealing with these problems towards a program, let us say, of famine relief. It should dispose them to show a greater willingness to take some chances on the side of liberality and generosity in this effort, rather than dispose him to be narrowly self-concerned. The obligation to provide shelter for those who are without shelter does not, of course, compel full support of every housing measure that is proposed in the Congress, but I think we might expect it to influence the attitude of men in politics or of those dealing with problems in this area to be somewhat more favorable to such a program. And certainly we should expect it to dispose them favorably toward, let us say, changing immigration laws so that displaced persons or refugees or others who suffer from poverty and from oppression may be given some haven and some harbor. Understanding of the concept of social justice will, of course, not immediately eliminate all injustices, but awareness of it and a deep understanding of it should be reflected in response and in understanding to statements, such as one which was made by the President of Argentina when he visited the United States, and spoke of the obligation of the rich and powerful nations towards the less favored and the impoverished ones. The Christian and the religious man's regard for the dignity of the human person should certainly incline him to oppose segregation and racial injustice, and these beliefs should sustain him in efforts to improve this relationship. His regard for the brotherhood of man should open his mind to international cooperation and to common effort. His understanding, I think, of the kind of mission of Western civilization and his acceptance of the fact that there is a kind of judgment, not only of persons, but a judgment of nations and a judgment of civilizations, should strengthen his interest in trying to improve such things as the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and the United Nations and the whole common effort which is being made today. Christian in politics should really be distinguished by his alertness to protect and defend the rights of individuals, the rights of the family, the rights of religious institutions and of schools, and of all other institutions from violation by the state or by other institutions or by persons who possess great power and strength. He should, I think, be the first to detect a truly totalitarian threat or movement and the last really to label every proposal for social reform as socialistic or totalitarian. The religious man should be distinguished, too, by the methods which he uses. He must, of course, hold fast to the moral law, remembering that the precepts of morality do not themselves change, even though the way in which they are applied to concrete acts may be modified as society regresses or is perverted. Maritain, in his essay on Man and the State, has said that moralists are unhappy people. He said if they announce fixed principles and absolutes, they're charged with being unresponsive to the needs of the time and to the forces of history. On the other hand, if they suggest some kind of accommodation, something short of the ideal, they're denounced, he said, as being compromisers or as being relativists or as giving away principle. Well, in somewhat the same way, people who deal in politics, those who deal with social problems, must be somewhat unhappy. They should know, insofar as they can determine what the absolute is and what the ideal is, but in the practical order, accommodation and some kind of adjustment, what we call compromise, is called for. And there have been in our own time men of great religious fervor who have been denounced as being unchristian or irreligious because of compromises and accommodations which they have directed and which they have recommended. The religious person in politics must at all times, and I think particularly in our own time, be particularly concerned to speak the truth. This is a question of using only proper and right means in order to accomplish your ends. He must be, in every case, aware of the importance of honesty. C.S. Lewis stated in an address to the students at Oxford that no one really should attempt to make his researches or his statements work out to edifying conclusions if this involved some destruction of the truth. For as he said, to do so is to offer to the author of all truth the unclean sacrifice of a lie. And so we must be careful not to return calumny and slander in the same token, but attempt to combat these with truth and honesty. And in the political field, not resort to the device of labeling, which really violates justice by its falseness, and it also offends against by its attack upon the dignity of a person, offends against charity. powerful personalities may be able to stand against these forces, but the weak are likely to be destroyed, and it is these that must be the concern of democracy and must be the concern of Christians and must be the concern of religious persons everywhere and at all times. The religious person dealing in politics and dealing with social problems at a time when tensions are high must strengthen his appeal to reason and attempt to discount the appeal to emotions. On the basis of moral principles, he must at all times strive to separate the good from the bad, even though the line may be a shifting one. He must remember and honor in action the rule that the end does not justify the means. He should carefully avoid a confusion such as that which is so often creeps into our discussions today, to the effect that because we are persuaded that our objectives are good and that our goals are pure, that we need not be so much concerned about the methods, that we can be somewhat dishonest in the name of honesty, that we can practice some injustice in the name of justice. We can be somewhat dishonorable in the name of honor. The Christian and the religious man, in his whole approach to these problems, must, insofar as he can, be truly humble, reflecting in his actions and in his attitudes an awareness of the great mystery of redemption itself and the shared mystery of the dignity of all people. He should be judged and should judge himself by the standard of whether his actions and his decisions have advanced the cause of justice, helped at least in some degree to achieve that degree of perfection which is possible in the temporal order. These may seem to be difficult standards and difficult demands, and they are, and their fulfillment does require a kind of heroic virtue. Suppose we might, in the language of religion, say that they call for sanctity, but in fact there never has been any other acceptable standard for religious people, for those who claim or those who assert that they are religious, than the standard of sanctity. And I would conclude with a reference to Thomas More, who was, I think, one of the first truly modern saints, a man who had to make choices under very hard and difficult conditions, under circumstances in which there really was no precedent, there really were no set forms in which he worked. He had to make them at a time when he was urged to relax, and when he was urged to attend to his own affairs, as we are today often urged. But nonetheless, he made the hard and the difficult choices. And he was able to say, shortly before his execution, that he had been in all things the king's good servant, but God's good servant first. And this, it seems to me, must be the standard for really all citizens and for all religious people in their effort to solve the problems of our own time, to be, insofar as they can, the good servant of their own day, the good servant of their own time, the good servant of their own profession and their own vocation, whatever that may be, the good servant, really, of the state. But in all these things, insofar as possible, God's good servant first.
Well, Senator McCarthy, we thank you from the bottom of our hearts for the sincere and challenging message which you have given us on this Religious Emphasis Day of Religious Participation Week here at the University. We hope we'll have many more chances to hear this kind of inspiring guidance again. So from all of us, thank you very much.